You're listening to the 5 Leadership Questions podcast, brought to you by Ministry Grid. Ministry Grid is an online church leadership and volunteer training platform offering a library of thousands of videos and a suite of powerful admin tools to provide practical training for every area of ministry in your church. Find out more and get a free 30-day trial at ministrygrid.com/howitworks. Welcome to the 5 Leadership Questions podcast. I'm your host, Barnabas Piper, here with Todd Adkins, the Director of Leadership at Lifeway Christian Resources. Today we're asking 5 leadership questions of Jeff Vanderstelt, who is the lead teaching pastor of Doxa Church in Bellevue, Washington. Welcome to the podcast, Jeff.
Thanks.
If we could just start off by you telling us a little bit about yourself, your current ministry role, leadership, how you got there, your family, just who you are and where you serve, where you lead, those kind of things.
All right. Well, presently I'm teaching at Doxa Church. We just replanted a church, started this past January. I have served for many years with the Selma Family of Churches, which is a church family network that came out of one church in Tacoma and now is about 25 churches around North America. And so I give vision to that and direction to that and help with training and equipping and developing of resources. But in a lot of ways, I'm doing that on the side while I'm giving the majority of my time to Doxa Church.
And for the listener's sake, tell us a little bit about the transition to Doxa. That's obviously, it's a unique situation where you just recently stepped into that role. And we, you know, we want to treat people with respect and speak kindly, but you came in the wake of Mark Driscoll stepping down. So tell us just a little bit about that transition, where the church is right now. Obviously, if people want to be praying for it, things like that. Just what's that like right now?
Yeah, so I do have a relationship that goes back quite a bit with Mars Hill and Mark because of my involvement with Acts 29. And when they were looking at replanting all of their campuses as individual churches, the Bellevue one was, I think, one of the more challenging situations because it's where Mark preached live and they didn't necessarily have an identified leader who could step up and begin to lead that. And so they called and asked if I would consider that, and through probably about 6 to 8 weeks of prayer and fasting and interacting with all of our church leadership at Soma Tacoma, we really knew the Lord was calling us to step into that and replant it as Doxa Church. And we were given the freedom to really reset culture, reset leadership, and just really get to start from new. And the reality is you never really start anything from new, do you? Because you're always dealing with people who have a history and a past. And the great thing is I feel like I got to step into a culture where they highly value God's word, love the preaching of the word, love Jesus, but just needed some help being kind of reset, go through some healing, some restoration, some rebuilding. And been doing that for the last 3.5 months. A lot of what we've been doing is just talking about what are the basic foundations of where we're going to be as a church so people can make a decision about whether they want to join Doxa, knowing what we believe, what we're going to be about, and how we're going to move forward. So we just finished that, spent the last 3 months just laying the foundation through our teaching.
So. That sounds like a pretty challenging process. I don't know if you'd had any experience doing anything like that before.
Yeah, I've been – actually, this will be the third time that I walked into a place where I had to do some rebuilding. The first time was stepping into a youth ministry in a church about 4,500. The youth pastor had been sexually involved with students, and I don't mean in any way to compare the two, but yeah, it was a broken situation. He went to prison for it, and I had to step in and rebuild the ministry, and God was really gracious and helped us rebuild that. And then Willow Creek called me in at one point when they had a bit of a leadership fallout in their student ministries, and they asked me to come in and rebuild that ministry as well. So I've done that in a youth ministry setting, never ever before though for an entire church. And so this is the first time, though I've actually helped churches talk through and work through transitions, I've never done one myself. Gotcha. So a lot of coaching, consulting around transitioning, but not actually having to transition a church all by myself.
Well, that I think does go into the first question of that we wanted to ask, which is who are you learning from right now?
It's interesting, as I've thought through recently who I'm learning most from, I feel like I'm learning most from the people of Doxa. because I'm walking into a new culture and I'm saying, you've got to help me know what happened here. What's the culture like on the east side of Seattle? It's very different than Tacoma. And so I'm doing a ton of listening. I feel like if you were to ask, like, who am I learning most from, it really is the people that I'm trying to lead so I can actually care for them well and understand their situation well. So on the ground, that's who I'm learning most from. In terms of influences outside of that community, I think Tim Keller's still been one of the biggest influences in my life in terms of understanding culture and how to bring the gospel into culture. And it feels like, to me, the east side of Seattle is almost like a Manhattan in the Northwest because of the business culture, the tech culture, the lots of money, lots of resource, lots of intellectual resource, a lot of really sharp thinkers. And so I'm learning how to even preach differently to a different context, different culture. So I'm learning from him again. It feels like I went back to him, and I'm learning all over just how would I rethink how I lead this church in light of that.
With this transition, it's a replant. It's learning a new church culture, a new city culture. You're starting. You're not, like you said, you're not starting from scratch, but you are building on some a new foundation. Do you have a sort of a singular point of emphasis you look at daily with your fellow leaders, your fellow team? You're looking at and saying, this is the thing that we keep our eye on. This is the point of emphasis for our leadership right now and at this point in the replant.
Yeah, there's actually a few things that we're asking about regularly. One is, how is the leadership health of our people, and particularly our leaders? And that includes our elders that I inherited. So we're really serious about leadership health, character development, transparency, making sure we're not creating a culture that's afraid to be honest about areas of struggle or sin or brokenness. So we're asking, does this feel like a safe, grace-filled culture to share struggles that we might be having? That's one big one. The second one I'd say that we're really working on is asking of everything we do, how will this lead to disciples making disciples? And I want to say that clearly. I think every church says they're committed to disciple making, but what I'm finding is there's a difference between having an organization commit to disciple making and training up your people to be disciples who make disciples. And so we're almost doing an audit on everything we do. Like, okay, is this going to take more away from our people from being developed or give to our people? How much energy and time is going to this event? Will it really produce disciples and make disciples, or will it really just produce a really great event that lots of people come to? So that's a big one, just trying to audit everything we do to say, is it really leading towards the disciple-making aspect of what a church should be about?
The first thing you said was about a grace-filled place. That is not something that the church is known for. What are just some of the practical ways, or maybe the measuring sticks that you look at and say, are we doing that well?
Yes, a few of the things are, from the stage, are we being open about our struggle? Are we willing in our preaching to admit where we struggle with the text in terms of our own application? Is there regular opportunity for repentance of sin? Is it happening not just from myself and the other elders, but from our leaders? Do they feel free to come to us and acknowledge when they're failing, when they're struggling? And then what do we do when they do acknowledge it? Does it feel like a fear environment, or does it feel like a faith and grace-filled environment where there's freedom to be restored and there's opportunity to be honest? So confession of sin will be one of the obvious ways that we see that happen. People willing to take risk and try new things is another way you know that you've got a grace-filled culture, because they're not afraid of failing. And I'm not saying we're there yet, but this is, like, as we got started, I realized a lot of our people want to do so well that oftentimes it was a performance-based culture, partly because of the culture of the east side. Partly maybe because I think in the church as a whole, we can tend to do that if we're not careful. And so really being able to value, hey, failure is good. It shows us our need for the gospel. We're going to boast in our weakness, not just in our strengths. So we talked a lot about how do we become a mourning and rejoicing culture, that we mourn our brokenness and we rejoice in the grace of the gospel in the midst of it. And Isaiah 61 has been a really key passage for us walking through that. Yeah, there's going to be devastations, and there's oaks of righteousness coming out of those devastations. So repentance and faith, mourning and rejoicing, confession of sin, places for grace. So that's going to be one of the key ways I think you see it, is both in the fact that we confess, but we also have a culture where people are starting to fail.
Yeah.
And we're rejoicing in that, because it means we're walking forward in grace. So
I think as churchmen, I know it's been a struggle for me in the past of what you measure and how you measure it. because not everything that is easy to measure is important. And we have a tendency to go after the things that may be more easy to measure, or at least traditional measurement. So how do you transition, or how do you measure some of the stuff that you're talking about?
Well, some of the
how
stuff
do you know I it's working at?
Yes, some of the stuff that I just said, there's subjective measurements, aren't there? It's interesting. One of the things that I've done to deal with the subjective measurements in objective ways is through a process like with elders, for instance. Some of the requirements of elders are very subjective. I mean, there's some in there that are like, clearly they're able to teach or not able to teach. But gentleness, how do you know? And there's, you know, because you make a, well, he's more gentle than the other, and, you know, he had a bad day or whatever. So I think there's ways to determine qualitatively more non-qualitative kinds of things. For instance, one of the questions we ask of our people is, if this person who we see as an elder in the church, if this person were to be in charge of your family, let's say your husband were to pass away and he had to step in and shepherd your family through this whole process, would you trust them? That's, you can answer objectively yes or no. Yeah. It'll tell you the subjective stuff, like, yeah, they're trustworthy, they're gentle, they're patient, they're kind, they're, I feel safe. Another one to ask is, you're going to go through church discipline in the next year or two. Would this be the person you'd want to take you through that? Okay, that's another objective question to a subjective reality. A third one might be, and we've done this before, is forget the biblical requirements of elder. I don't want you to have them in your mind. Tell me what this person's known for. Like, if you were to say, I know their friends, I know their neighbors, I know their coworkers, I know, what are they known for? And whatever they say will be very objective, but it'll match up to what feels subjective in the requirements. So that's one. What are we known for? Reputation.
Quick interruption. Getting people in the church to answer those questions is putting them in a spot where they're evaluating leaders. That does not always feel safe. How do you help them feel safe to evaluate? Because, I mean, those sort of case study questions make a lot of sense to put a concrete context on a sort of a malleable thing. But to answer that question is risky.
Yeah, I think you got to give them other opportunities before that, where they get to answer other kinds of questions and show that you're willing to hear it, you're willing to be corrected. I think if, for instance, early on at Doxa, there was something I did that was I'd say a minor offense to somebody, but it still offended them nonetheless. And I had told our church, if I ever do anything that would cause you to have a hard time trusting me or feel hurt by me, or please come to me. Well, it took her a while to come to me, and she finally did. And then when I addressed it, we got that all cleaned up. And then I told the whole church, this is what just happened this week. I loved it. I want more of you to do that. Please keep doing that. And so, and then I told them how our elders did that with me a few weeks ago, and it was a really hard day for me. And I celebrate it because it was a sign of success in our church that we were willing to have a hard conversation with the guy who's up teaching, and I needed to hear that. And so I think it's every single time we have one of those, we celebrate it. Back to the metrics. Metrics are really what you measure and celebrate, right? So if you don't ever talk about those kinds of things publicly and say, that's a very good thing, we want more of that, people will think, no, you don't want more of that.
That's lip service.
That's right. When we did it before, we got slapped, you know? So the more that you celebrate those hard moments, even if they don't do it perfectly, the more that you're going to create a safer environment for more of those to happen.
Well, so much of what you talk about is culture. Yeah. And what you've just talked about is one of the two key ways to embed culture is what you celebrate and what you measure, what you control, what you reprimand. All those things send very clear signals. And again, some people may not realize what you're doing, but when you do that, you are shaping culture.
Absolutely. And when you do it consistently, you're saying it wasn't just a one-off. So I think we have to identify, and it's back to your metrics question, we have to identify what are the things that we want to see start happening around here as a norm. I mean, another example, and I don't know if you want to shift, but when you talk about baptisms. So when we baptize and I get someone out of the water of baptism, and I say to them, the next thing I want to do is encourage you to be able to be in the waters baptizing someone else soon. So what I'm telling our culture is what we measure is not just me baptizing, but the people that we baptize getting to baptize people themselves so they can actually obey the commandment of Jesus, which is to make disciples, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So when we say what we're really celebrating is not just the leaders baptizing people, but the people we baptize getting to baptize people.
It's not a more sanctified baptism when you do it.
That's right, yeah. So those are huge moments. So I would measure how many people in our church got to baptize somebody this last year? Not just how many baptisms. That's a different kind of culture then. Mm-hmm. And so each one of those is taking it another level. Even like giving, we decided in giving, let's not just measure growth in giving, let's measure growth in average Joe giving. So we've identified which average Joe makes a year in the East Side and what would giving look like if he grew up in giving. And so it's like, I don't care if we have more money coming in. I want our people to be developed. Another one for us is, could they articulate how we're helping them grow in one or two things this next year as a disciple in Jesus? If they're a member of our church and they can't articulate how the leaders are helping them grow in a particular area of their own life, then we're probably not faithfully equipping the saints for works of ministry. So those are different kinds of metrics we're trying to set in place. Some of those are for the grace culture we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Some of them are for ongoing growth as disciple makers. Hopefully it's still grace-based.
That's interesting because I remember 2 years ago, a quote that you said, and I haven't stolen it. I really want to because I think it's gold. Which is, if you say you're on mission, and you don't mention Jesus, then you're on somebody else's mission. And so I really think what you just said really backs that up.
That's actually one of the things that I think we should measure too. Is ask your people how many conversations do you get to have regularly in a week about Jesus. I think it should be a goal that we talk about Jesus on a daily basis. Like that should be one of the metrics we're aiming for in our own personal development, because that will create a grace-based culture, because you're going to have to talk about the gospel. Now, you can talk about Jesus in legalistic ways, I know, but hopefully we're having a culture that loves Jesus so much that they just can't go a day without talking to somebody about him.
Metrics and discipleship are they don't always seem to go together, but I appreciate how you just laid it out in terms of almost like relational measurements. It's almost like checking in with your spouse to see, hey, how are we doing? And it's not a numeric based or a grade based thing, but just they're like checkpoints along the way. And I think that strikes me as a really healthy thing for a church because numbers can be soulless if that's all they are. So I really appreciate that emphasis. The third question we wanted to ask you is, you're obviously in a challenging situation, but is there one or two particular obstacles that you're currently facing in leadership? And this can be personal, so you seeing something in your own life and saying, that's something I need to overcome, or for your team and the culture of the organization saying, that is something we are trying to move over or move past.
Yeah, there's a couple. On the personal one, first of all, I'd say I'm learning that I have a language I use that is not often communicating what I want it to communicate. You'd think, well, I'm in the Northwest. I just went from Tacoma to Bellevue. That's only 38 miles away. It's not that big of a deal. What I've realized, however, though, is when you walk into another church, they already had a language. And when you say certain things that you thought are the same words, they're not actually the same words. They're the same words, but not the same meaning. And so that's one of the biggest learnings I'm having is I'm actually saying things and not realizing I'm saying something I don't mean to say. In particular, I'll give you an example. Whenever I've given an example in my messages of this is how I live this out, or how I know of somebody who lived this out, what they heard was a very prescriptive, this is how you must live it out. Mm-hmm. So I give an example of a missional community that's reaching a local high school, working with a football team. And what I got back from many people is like, we're trying to find a high school because we want to be on mission. We want to be in a missional community, but we just can't find a high school that has a football team that would work like you guys did at that one school. And it's not because it's in no way because people aren't intelligent. They're very intelligent. What they were used to hearing.
It's a translation issue.
Yeah, it's a translation issue. So what they were used to hearing was the illustration was like, this is how I want it to look. Do it like this. Mm-hmm. And I'm just giving it as an example to inspire them and hopefully create a place of creativity around the idea. So that's one thing where I realized I want to say, here's one illustration. There's 100 more. The other thing I realized is because I think it's the East Side, Bellevue is a very hardworking culture, very high view of authority, really eager to do good work at Microsoft or wherever else they might be. There can tend to be, if I'm not aware of it, me giving a new standard that becomes a performance grid. And by saying, hey, well, this is what we're going to be about, they really want to do well and they want to do the best they can. And if I'm not careful, I'm creating a new legalism. And so I've failed a couple times in giving a standard that I only meant to be an illustration or an idea.
Does that change how you communicate? You know, so we were just talking about measurements. for a performance-based person, measurements are everything. I want to be an A-plus human. And so does that change how you communicate those? Do you sort of keep those in the leadership in terms of the metric side of things?
I think some of them, yes. And then some we've had to, like I've said from the stage, hey, we want to call everybody to have a discipleship plan, meaning we actually know what you're working on and we want to help you work on it. And that came across as, okay, is it going to be, you're going to be like, are we going to put a plan forward and you're going to say that's not a good one? Right. And that's going to be critiqued. And then I realized what I needed to say is, we want you all to know we're completely committed to you growing up as a disciple. And so we want to help you formulate something that would be best for your own development at this stage in your life. So I had to qualify it. And then the other side of it was, I really realized some people, their learning path to get to where we want them to go could be a year, two, three, 4 years. So I started saying that too. You know, we're okay if you're moving toward learning how to be a disciple who makes disciples. It's okay if it takes 3 or 4 years. In fact, if you try and fail, that's a success. So even redefining what success is, that failure is success because you tried, that all of us are learning, so we're all going to make mistakes. Like that metric, saying that's really what performance is the freedom to fail now. And so, and then you have to reiterate it over and over again. So like some of our posts that we put out were posts like, we're telling stories of missional communities that are just getting started and they're making a mess and they're not doing that great. And so what we're doing is we're actually saying part of the measurement is we're measuring failure as a success because it means you tried, you stepped out, you took a step of faith.
Do people respond well to that? And is it mind blowing at this point?
Yeah, it's hard. You know, I've only been in it 14 weeks, and so half of what I'm saying I could be completely wrong on, right? I mean, because you really don't know. Right. It's what I'm learning in the moment.
Okay, yeah.
And then I think you said, you know, other obstacles our leaders are facing. The other one is I just think learning how to trust one another. When you've been through a place where a lot of leadership wounds are there, the idea that you'd step out and be vulnerable when you don't know what might happen, that's a big one. So learning how to build trust, which means we have to spend a lot of time together. We're eating lunch every week together on Tuesdays. We're having a meeting with husbands and wives and kids once a month together. We're going to have once a quarter family time together. Like, we've got a lot of relational equity to build up before we're going to have the kind of trust that will lead an organization like a church really well. So,
well, that kind of transitions very well to the next question, which is, how do you lead in your home? Like, what does that look like?
Well, I lead with my wife. In that sense, my complementary convictions are that we really do this together, and she's an amazing helper and incredibly effective partner in ministry. And so that means I listen a lot. We actually take every Friday off together. We generally, if I'm not traveling, generally we'll go out to lunch, and I regularly ask her a set of questions just so she can feed back into how we're doing. The first one is, how can I better love and lead you? How can I lead as a servant and love you well? Second, how can I better shepherd and love our children? And then third, you're watching my walk with Jesus. How can I better love and worship and serve Jesus? And I just let her speak into those things in my life as a leader in her home. And I'm convinced she is the best person to give me feedback because she's most affected by my poor or strong leadership in the household. And then now as my kids are getting older, as I sit down with them, I ask them similar questions. I'm letting them speak into my parenting and tell me what they love about it, what I can grow in, where the areas are.
What ages are they?
They're 13, 10, and 8.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're starting to speak into it more and more.
Yeah, they're probably starting to speak into a lot of things.
Yeah, they are.
You're getting a full 360 review.
Oh, gosh. I sure am. Yeah. So, and then we try to take Saturday as a family day. So I work Sunday through Thursday as my work week. Friday is more of a rest for me and then Janie, and then more family day on Saturday. And presently, I'm not nearly as ordered and structured as some people are in how they lead their family. I try to get some discussion around the table, around the word, or around something they're learning. But I'd say that's not as consistent as some people are rigid and they do it every – I'm not that – structured probably in my style. I'm much more in the crack kind of leadership, like in the middle of life and the spaces and the gaps. I'm kind of like paying attention to what's going on. I'll pull them aside and say, let's talk about what you just did. And then it's gospel application to that particular issue. And then every night I'm with each one of them at bedtime we're kind of rehearsing the day, praying with them. And because we do missional community together, it's an integrated ministry life. So we're not separating our kids off to different ministry. They're really involved in the ministry that we're in, and we're in the ministry they're in. So it's much more integrated because they're with us in so much of what we do.
So thinking, you know, so you're talking about how you are leading your kids who are quickly becoming adults. Think back to when you were just older than a kid, 20-year-old Jeff, looking forward to leadership. You know, maybe you were in a leadership position at 20. If you could go back and talk to that person, what would you tell him to prepare him for leadership? So what would you tell your 20-year-old self? One piece of advice to help you prepare to be a leader.
The most important thing is character development. And the only way to get character development is to have people that you let speak into your life that get to tell you the truth about what they see. I mean, I think that's the number one thing. Competencies and everything else, they'll come. But if your character doesn't get developed, that'll be the one thing that takes you out anyway. So having a heart that's open for older, wiser people, men and women, to speak into, to confront you in sin, to call you to repent, and to trust that you actually really need it.
It's really good advice. And it's interesting how consistently we hear from leaders on the podcast that exact piece of advice, or some form of it, that it is a, you start with character and the skills take care of themselves, the experience takes care of itself, et cetera.
I think what's interesting is, and I don't even know if we probably have already said this on a podcast, but really discipleship and leadership development aren't that much different. The difference between a discipleship and leadership development is you're moving people from character to competency. And so it's so important to lay that foundation. It's so important to have. There are plenty of people out there that have, they may be competent in some leadership skills, but ultimately if it's not built on that foundation of character, it will crumble.
We really appreciate you being on with us, Jeff, taking the time out of your busy schedule here. Obviously, we're at the Gospel Coalition Conference right now recording this, and so Jeff is running from thing to thing, giving his time to a million different people. So really, thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, that was this week's episode of the 5 Leadership Questions podcast. We would love it if you would be so kind as to jump on iTunes and leave us a rating and review. That'll help other leaders like yourself find the podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and tune in again next week. Thank you for listening to the 5 Leadership Questions podcast. To learn more about how you can train leaders in your church, visit ministrygrid.com/howitworks and watch a short demo video. For participating, you will get a free 30-day trial for your entire church. Again, that's ministrygrid.com/howitworks.